Okay, this is a good stop for me to ask if anyone has any questions. Anyone have any questions?
We have a question about the essay. What you are reading from us.
Okay, yeah, Mark was just telling me that there were some questions about the essay. And let me start by saying I realize there's not much in Estonian, not much in Russian about the topic. Right? Yeah. Okay, number one, we are going to deal with that topic to some extent in the class. Not today, but before the class is over, we will deal with that topic. Number two, it's a personal reflection, okay? And there is no right answer, there is no wrong answer to the essay. What I want you to do is I want you to take the topic and do some serious thinking about it. Now, let me explain a little bit about the topic itself so that it helps give you some perspective on this. You see, in the Old Testament, worship was very active. When you went to the temple, you brought an animal to the priest. You put your hands on the head of that animal while the priest took a knife and cut its throat. You saw the blood squirting out. I know it's pretty gory. As the animal collapsed, you stayed there while the animal was dressed out and certain parts of the animal were put on the altar to be burned. In the Old Testament, at Passover, you actually brought the animal into your home and lived with it. The children fed it, the animal was there, and the children played with it and things like that for days before that animal was offered as a sacrifice. Worship was very active. It was something that was deeply personal, and you were personally involved with every aspect of the worship experience. In the church, worship is very passive, which I think personally is one of the things that has deeply hurt the entire church experience. But for the most part, you sit there and listen to people speak. In America, you listen to people speak for sometimes 15, 20, 30 minutes. If they go longer than 20 or 30 minutes, you probably are not even listening to them anymore. You're thinking about what you're going to do after church or what you did last night or what is coming up during the week or something like that. And yes, you do in a very small sense participate in song. And if it's a charismatic type of church, okay, you're clapping your hands while you're singing, you're standing up, you're moving around a little bit, it's still passive. You did not choose the songs. If those songs do not happen to speak to your heart that day or that night, whenever you're worshiping, you may still go through the motions, but you're not really heavily involved in the actual experience. And in prayer time, with rare exception, your only active involvement in prayer is a very short period of silent prayer. You do not choose the scriptures, you do not choose the topic that the speaker speaks on. Prayers generally are not necessarily something that touches you. Occasionally, it may be something that touches you. But the worship experience in Christian churches today, worldwide, is very passive. Okay? And the topic that I want you to write on is you are going to have examples. I've given you a few now. We'll do more later. But the topic you're going to write on is how can the Christian world incorporate examples from the Old Testament of a more active worship to make worship in the Christian sense a more active activity in your Christian life. Okay, it's written a little bit different in the topic, but that is the basic topic. How can the Christian worship go, following the examples of the Old Testament, how can the Christian worship go from being a passive experience to being an active experience? And I think one of the things that was very important in the Old Testament period, both for the Israelites, but also for all of the other peoples, was that worship was a very active experience. Let me go one step further. The church struggles to get, even in America, even in, well, even more so in Europe, the church struggles to get, oftentimes, a small handful of people to come together on Sunday for worship. That very same Sunday in the afternoon, there may be a football game. Thousands of people, without doing anything, thousands of people come to the football game. What's the difference? My guess is that one of the differences is that the football game is not really a passive experience, because the people are actively involved in their minds and in their hearts with what is happening out on that field. They are not just watching a bunch of people run around on the field and kick a ball. They are actively involved in the support for their team, in the guessing what the strategy is going to be, or the tactics that are going to be used by a particular player. And you can go on and on with the things that are part of that ball game. And thousands of people will come to the football game. But you may only have a handful of people that come to the worship service. And a lot of them are sitting there at least moderately bored with what they are experiencing. And so what I want you to do is to reflect on how, following the Old Testament example of active worship experience. The worship experience in the Christian world can be made more active and less passive. Okay? There's no right or wrong answer to it. It's your reflection on these things.
Are we writing or giving an answer?
What's that?
Are we writing or we pick right or wrong answer?
No, there's no right or wrong answer.
We just write.
Well, you have to write something meaningful. You cannot write the sentence, "I think this is a stupid topic for the essay," and then next sentence, "I think this is a stupid topic for the essay." Next sentence, "I think this is a stupid topic for the essay." No, you have to write something meaningful. And I mean, you do not even have to totally agree with what I just said. You might think it's more active than it is. But I want you to reflect on the idea of how to make Christian worship more active. And I'm sure that there are many ways that you can do it. But the Old Testament immediately has a lot of, I guess you might say, direction in terms of worship being an active experience and not a passive experience. And so that's the idea of the essay. Okay, I also, Mark was saying you were a little worried about the final exam. So I made the final exam up. And I told Mark to tell you that it's really hard because I failed it the first 5 times I took it. But since I made it up, I didn't fail it. No, it's not a bad exam. And actually, I collaborated with Mark to try to make sure that it's a reasonable exam. And it does have an essay. By the way, your essays, both the reflection essay and the essay portion of the final exam, those are written in your language. Okay? Because Mark is going to work with graders to be sure that it's written in whatever is your language you feel most comfortable. And that will be done after I'm already back in China, I think. And Mark will send me the results if I want to know it, but that part will be done through here. And there's 20 multiple choice on the final exam. And then there's the one, actually there's several essay topics, and you choose one of the essay topics and you write about that. The essay topics are not so much reflection as using, on the final, as using what we've talked about in class. But the essay, as I recall, you have one essay that you have to write, and you choose from among several topics. And I give you the several topics. And hopefully for everybody, at least one of the topics will be something that is interesting to them. And so whichever topic you choose to write on, it's okay. But it's to talk about that topic in regard to the Old Testament. Okay? So I think when you get the final exam, you'll see it's not horrible. You'll have to study for it, but it's not horrible. Okay, so all of that having been said, let's move on and let's talk about the next name of God, which is in many ways perhaps the most profound of all of the names of God, and that's Yahweh. I guess maybe a place to start in this is simply to give you a couple of interesting details about this name. In Hebrew, by the New Testament time, this particular word was pronounced only one time a year by the high priest on the Day of Atonement, which is the end of the holy days in usually September of every year. And the high priest would come out when the temple was standing. He would offer half of the blood of a sacrifice in the Holy of Holies, the most sacred place in the Jewish temple, and half of the blood would be offered at the altar of sacrifice outside the temple building. And then the high priest would raise his hands in the priestly blessing, "The Lord bless you and keep you, the Lord make his face to shine upon you," and so on like that. And only he would say, "Yahweh bless you and keep you, Yahweh make his face to shine upon you," and so on. And that would be the only time in the entire year that this word would actually be spoken. And it was considered basically sacrilegious, almost blasphemous, for anybody to speak this word. This is by New Testament time. For anybody to speak this word other than the high priest on that one day of atonement. And so after the Jewish temple was destroyed, then the priests no longer came out and offered that blessing because there was no temple. And in Hebrew, is at one point say, "We have Abraham for our father. You don't even know who your father is." Now, some people, by the way, say things about we don't know, those who kind of doubt the story of the virgin birth and so on, they talk about the different stories that circulated of how Mary became pregnant and stuff like that. It's worth realizing that when the Pharisees say to Jesus, "We have Abraham for our father, you don't even know who your father is," that there is actually a big slap in the face going on to Jesus on their part. Because, number one, they didn't believe in the virgin birth. And number two, they're saying, you know, "We don't know how Mary got pregnant. If it wasn't from Joseph, then you don't know who it was that really is your father." And then Jesus says to them, "Before Abraham was, I am." And the high priest takes the knife and he slits his robe and he rips it open. Not the high priest, I'm sorry, the leaders of the Pharisees. They do this and they rip it open and they cry out, "Ah!" And it seems like it's a really overreaction to what Jesus says. Well, he did actually, in that moment, claim to be God. Not because he said, "Before Abraham was, I am," but because he actually said to them, "Before Abraham was, Yahweh." And he said the word that would only be pronounced by the priest one time on the Day of Atonement. That was the word he spoke. Yes, he said, literally, before Abraham was, I am. But he actually pronounced that word. That was sacrilege, unless he was the high priest and it was the Day of Atonement, or he was God. And you can see in that encounter that they are saying that he makes himself equal with God. And you look at that, and if you read it in our translations, you look at that and you wonder, huh? It doesn't come through so clearly. But if you understand what was actually taking place there, then yes, he did actually tell them. He's God. He made himself equal with God. He dared to use the word Yahweh. And when he dared to use the word Yahweh, if he was not the priest, the only other person that had the right to use it was God. So, another story about this particular word as a name for God. Okay, so let's talk about the word Yahweh. We'll start now and probably spend a good part of the next session as well talking about this particular name for God. First of all, it is the personal name of God. It's like my personal name is Richard. Mark Nelson's personal name is Mark. Whatever your first name is, that is your personal name. And people can talk about their last name, their surname, and that gives you a family identification. But in my case, the family name is Bennett. Okay, so you can talk about Bennett. Do you mean my father, Robert? Do you mean my mother, Gladys? My sister, Frances? My sister, Kathy? My son, Chris? There's a family of Bennett. When you say Richard, you are now moving beyond the family to the individual. And oh, that one. And now it brings into your mind and into your frame of reference all the details of who this person is. That's the idea of Yahweh. To digress for a minute, I told you in Islam, the word for God in Islam is Allah, which is the generic or general form for God like El. But that is as close as Islam gets to their God. And you see, there is no personal name for Allah that has been communicated to them. And in the Jewish world, one of the things that distinguishes the Jewish world, not only from Islam, but from all of the other gods, is that God revealed his personal name to them. And they know God, Elohim, not just by his generic name, God, but they know him personally. Because he gave them his personal name. And This is a dramatic difference in religious experience from all of the other religions in the ancient world, because they know the personal name of God. And as I said, in much of the Old Testament, you see it in translation, it says the Lord God. But in Hebrew, if you're reading it, it says Yahweh Elohim, which is literally Yahweh God, which is intended to take the generic God and tell you specifically which God it is that the Israelites worship. And it would be essentially the equivalent of saying the God Yahweh. But the way it is written is Yahweh Elohim. Well, the personal name of God was also oftentimes in part added to people's names as an act of identification and devotion with Yahweh. So, for instance, in the Old Testament, you have such names as Jehu, Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah. All of these have a part of this in that personal name. In Jehu, it has the last part, the H. Hezekiah has the H as the last part. Jehoshaphat has the first part, Yah, right here, included in the personal name. And as you go through the Old Testament, frequently you find names of people that have this, some portion of the word Yahweh in their name. You have it today. The current president of the state of Israel, not the current president, the current prime minister of the state of Israel, is Benjamin Netanyahu. Yahu is a form of the word Yahweh. And it's added into his name. The idea is that this shows a particular identification with Yahweh and the people of Yahweh. Today, it is probably less significant than it was in biblical times. But in Old Testament times, it was probably a much more profound statement to add some form of Yahweh into a person's name. God told the people that he would give the people a new name by which they would know him. And that was when he revealed his personal name to them, Yahweh. And if you remember, perhaps the most dramatic event of all is when Moses is up on Mount Sinai and he says to God, who's sending me? Okay, I go back to Egypt and I tell them the God of their ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me, and so on like that. But he said, what's that going to mean to them? And God says tell them Yahweh sent you. And Yahweh is the personal name. You do sometimes find it before the time of Moses, but it is most commonly found in the Old Testament after the time of Moses. And in fact, if you go to the JEDP theory for a minute, the J represents the Yahweh, and the people who like to cut up the Old Testament that way, they will pull all the passages in the Old Testament that use the term Yahweh out and suggest that that was one original version of the Old Testament, and then all of those that use Elohim, that was a different original version of the Old Testament. And they try to present it that way, and that it was eventually merged together. And so you see mostly the use of Elohim before Moses, and there are only a few situations or times when Yahweh is used before Moses. But the patriarchs knew God as El or Elohim primarily. But God's personal name, which you see a few times, was Yahweh. And the fact is that Yahweh was known not through nature or natural revelation. In other words, you don't get an understanding of Yahweh by simply looking at creation. It has to come as a direct revelation from God, arising out of the special relationship God established between himself and the people of Israel. As I think I've said before, it is a form of the verb to be. And in modern Hebrew, the verb to be, you have a future form and you have a past form of the verb. But there is no present tense for the verb to be. There is no am, are, is. And when you're speaking modern Hebrew, if you want to say, I am happy, then you simply say, Ani Tov. Well, that's I am good, not happy. So if you want to say, I am good, you simply say, Ani Tov. Because the word am is simply implied in that particular sentence. And it's the same way throughout modern Hebrew. There is no actual am, is, or are, which is the present tense of the verb to be. Because the present tense of the verb to be would involve this particular word. And so there's the past tense, there's the future tense, but there's no present tense, which in itself has some meaning, because Yahweh is, in a sense, simply, I exist. From everlasting until everlasting, from eternity past to eternity future, I am. And that's the concept that Yahweh presents. It can also mean I cause to be, or in some cases some people would say I will cause to be. And you come up with the same word, whether it's as a causative idea or it's simply the verb to be. In the future tense, which is associated with it, it simply means I will be. I will be there I will simply be. Some people say that maybe it has no actual meaning. I don't agree with that idea. But some people say maybe it has no actual meaning, but when Moses said to God, "Who shall I say has sent me?" God didn't actually answer Moses. God simply said to Moses, "Yahweh," which meant nothing to anybody. And it was sort of a subtle, don't ask type of statement. But it's what I believe, and what most scholars, I think, believe, is the personal name of God. And it was revealed to the Israelites to allow them to develop a much more close and personal relationship to their God than just simply Elohim. And this made a dramatic difference between the way the Israelites understood their religious experience and the way the peoples of the other nations understood it. Because for them, they were invited into a personal experience, not just simply a servitude or servant type experience with their God.